details on their Facebook page. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Tonight's forecast, slight chance of showers after 2 a.m. with temperatures 58 to 62.
They talk about doing something, they don't actually do the hard work of making it happen.
The federal government is in day one of a shutdown after Democrats withheld votes for a spending bill to try and extend health care funding.
So what happens next?
For Wednesday, October 1st, it's All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The government shutdown puts added pressure on a key group of workers already facing high levels of stress and low levels of staff, air traffic controllers.
Not only is your career at stake, but the right to have a union will be at stake during that time.
Ahead, we'll also hear the latest developments of how AI chatbots affect mental health.
And hear from a top news executive about struggling with depression.
My wife said, until you can talk about it, you'll never be free.
Plus, start thumping your chest now. Matthew McConaughey joins Wildcard.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. On the first day of the government shutdown, Senate Republicans tried to pass a bill that would fund federal agencies through November 21st. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports the measure failed.
On the first day of the shutdown, Senate Majority Leader John Thune called on Democrats to back a stopgap funding bill.
We are just one Senate roll call vote away from ending the shutdown.
The top Senate Democrat, Chuck Schumer, insisted any deal had to extend health care subsidies that are expiring at the end of the year.
It's clear that the way out of this shutdown is to sit down and negotiate with Democrats to address the looming health care crisis that faces tens of millions of American families.
Top leaders aren't talking, but there is a bipartisan Senate group trying to find a path to reopening the government and keeping tax credits to keep health care affordable for middle and working class people. It's unclear how much progress they are making. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
The price of gold hit a new record as uncertainty deepens during the government shutdown. Gold sales can jump when anxious investors seek safe havens for their money. Earlier this year, gold and other metals saw gains as President Trump's tariffs plunged the world into economic uncertainty. And the Trump administration's government efficiency effort, DOGE, hasn't delivered on its promises. That's according to an NPR analysis of federal data, as NPR's Stephen Fowler reports.
Agencies ordered by DOGE to drastically slash their workforce over the last 8 months are now hiring back hundreds of workers. Despite DOGE's promise that cutting contracts and terminating leases would shrink the federal budget, Treasury data shows spending has increased by hundreds of billions of dollars. When it first launched this year, DOGE's savings and efficiency tracker was full of errors, overstatements, and unverifiable claims. That remains true today. The White House declined to answer NPR's questions about these shortcomings, but said President Trump was, quote, given a clear mandate to reduce waste, fraud, and abuse, and he is delivering on that commitment. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
Jane Goodall has died. The legendary primatologist transformed our understanding of apes. She was 91. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has this remembrance.
Jane Goodall became fascinated with Africa and its animals as a child. After going to secretarial school, she visited a friend in Kenya and introduced herself to the famous paleontologist Louis Leakey. He hired her as his secretary, then later sent her off to Tanzania to study humanity's closest living relative, the chimpanzee. Goodall was the first researcher to live among wild chimps and learn their ways. Within months, she made a startling discovery. Like humans, they could make and use tools. Her observations of chimp families were featured in numerous books and popular magazines like National Geographic. Later in life, she founded the Jane Goodall Institute and became a passionate advocate for the protection of wildlife and the environment. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR. New Mexico lawmakers are trying to shore up safety net spending in a state with one of the highest rates of Medicaid and federal food assistance enrollment. The effort comes in response to cuts made in President Trump's signature spending package. New Mexico legislators want more money for food assistance, while Democratic Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is calling for a quick response to federal Medicaid and tax cuts signed by Trump. She wants to provide the state grants to stabilize health care in rural areas. With the government shut down, some students and parents are worried about what that means for college financial aid. More from NPR's Sequoia Carrillo.
It's October 1st, and normally that means the Education Department would publish this year's Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA. The form is mandatory for students to get financial aid packages from colleges, and sending it in early is helpful to schools. This year, however, the administration released the FAFSA 1 week early, avoiding any complications from the shutdown and getting students the form in a prompt manner. Any student, regardless of income, who wants to be considered for federal, state, and school financial aid programs can fill out the FAFSA now on studentaid.gov. Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News.
Coffee brand Maxwell House is downsizing to Maxwell Apartment for a limited one-year lease. The company says it's rebranding to meet the needs of the everyday consumer in America, where more than a third of people rent their homes instead of own. Customers will still buy the coffee under its original name. Maxwell Apartment is part of a limited-time marketing campaign. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It is 5:06. You're listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library have their big fall book sale going on now through October 3rd at Westgate Mall, 10 to 6 each day. More news is next on KAXC.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. The federal government is in the first day of a shutdown. The shutdown began at midnight last night. That's when the most recent funding bill expired. Senate Democrats blocked a bill funding government operations in an effort to try and get Republicans to agree to extend soon-to-expire health care subsidies and other health care-related funding. It is a move that carries political risks, but one that most Democratic members of Congress are on board with. One of the few exceptions is Nevada Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, who voted along with Republicans for the funding bill. Cortez Masto joins us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hello, Scott. Great to join you.
Let's start with that. Why did you break ranks with so many other Democrats on this vote?
Well, you know, coming from Nevada, I know it was important to avoid a costly shutdown that would harm Nevadans. And I honestly didn't think it would be appropriate to hand more power to this reckless administration. I think it's important for us to really work in a bipartisan way to solve problems, mm-hmm. including addressing this looming healthcare crisis that we have. I see it in Nevada when I'm home. Mm-hmm. And we should be working together to solve those problems. We don't need to shut down the government to do that.
We saw you in a lot of animated conversations on the Senate floor last night around this vote. Do other Democrats share your concerns, Democrats who might have voted for the shutdown?
Well, absolutely. I think we are all seeing, because of the unfortunate policies of this administration, the Republicans in control, in our own home states, we're seeing it. I'm seeing in Nevada, high mm-hmm. costs, right? An economy in slowdown, this looming healthcare crisis. The last legislation that the Republicans passed, they took away Medicaid for millions of Americans. And now we're on the cusp of taking away the Affordable Care Act.
Well,
many people in my state are harmed by this. And so it does require us to really focus on how we solve these problems, mm-hmm. And talk and work and get together and as members of Congress do our job, pass appropriations bills, but solve problems for Americans. And this is part of why we need to continue to work. And I will be focused on talking to my colleagues across the aisle and with my colleagues in my own caucus to figure out how we come out of this and solve these problems.
Well, then I want to get your take on one of the arguments that many of your Democratic colleagues are saying, that this is truly the only point that the minority party has to exert leverage at the moment in Congress, especially given how little the Trump administration is negotiating with Democrats on most things. So why not, if you have those concerns, if you see this as a crisis, what is your argument against using the leverage of a shutdown to try and address it?
Well, I've just said, I was just home in Nevada. I was talking to so many people. The challenge we have right now is high costs. I see it in Nevada, grocery costs, clothing, energy costs. I also know that we are seeing a downturn in our tourism economy nationally because of the policies of this administration. Mm-hmm. And as you well know, Scott, it impacts Nevada. Las Vegas is the gold standard for tourism and travel around the world. And we are seeing an impact to our tourism and travel industry as well. Those are hundreds of thousands of jobs in Nevada. Let me just add, I also know that a shutdown would also harm many of my independent contractors that are my skilled labor. And they work out at the test site. There's a couple of hundred of them that would lose their jobs. And so my challenge here is I don't believe in really this idea that we have to harm some Americans to solve problems for others. Mm-hmm. I think the goal here is for all of us to work together to help everyone and solve Americans' problems. And that includes around this healthcare crisis.
The shutdown is underway. As you know, as happens when this begins, both sides are blaming the other in different ways. I want to play you something that Vice President Vance said at a White House briefing today.
The Democrats did nothing to help us. In fact, we would have loved to have the Democrats helping us, but they didn't. They talk about doing something. They don't actually do the hard work of making it happen.
How concerned are you that as this goes on, as those economic effects that you're worried about start to take place, that it's Democrats who will get the blame for this impasse?
Yeah, let me jump back here and first to say that's a lie. And what's coming out of the vice president's mouth, that the Democrats weren't willing to talk. Mm-hmm. It's a lie. And I can point to a number of things where there's mischaracterizations. But more importantly, we have the White House and the president of the United States and the vice president, instead of trying to bring the sides together to work to solve this problem, they are throwing mischaracterizations out there. They're mm-hmm. lying. And they're not trying to help, and they're not being constructive to help us solve this problem. So, with that said, this is the role of Congress mm-hmm. to appropriate and to keep this government open. And that's why, for me, in the Senate, mm-hmm. I will continue to reach across the aisle to my colleagues, figure out where we can come together to open up this government and solve the problems around the healthcare crisis that we have right now. And I'm telling you, the looming one mm-hmm. is this cliff for the Affordable Care Act that is going to impact people in my state, working families in my state and their children who rely on the Affordable Care Act.
We're just about out of time for this segment, though, but I really appreciate you joining us. That is Nevada Senator Catherine Cortez Masto. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Artificial intelligence chatbots like ChatGPT have become increasingly popular among teenagers and young adults who use this technology to role play, friendship, romance, even mental health support. But these virtual relationships can pose risks to the well-being of youth, including putting them at risk of suicide. As NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports, parents and online safety advocates want laws to regulate this technology. And a warning, this story discusses suicide.
Matthew Rain and his wife Maria had no idea that their 16-year-old son Adam was deep in a suicidal crisis until he took his own life in April. Later, looking through his phone, they stumbled upon his conversations with ChatGPT.
Let us tell you, as parents, you cannot imagine what it's like to read a conversation with a chatbot that groomed your child to take his own life.
That's Matthew Rain testifying at a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee hearing. He has filed a lawsuit against ChatGPT's developer, OpenAI, alleging that the app led their son to his death. Rain told lawmakers that his son had started using ChatGPT for help with homework, but soon the chatbot had become his closest confidant.
ChatGPT told my son, "Let's make this space the first place where someone actually sees you." ChatGPT encouraged Adam's darkest thoughts and pushed him forward. When Adam worried that we, his parents, would blame ourselves if he ended his life, ChatGPT told him, "That doesn't mean you owe them survival. You don't owe anyone that."
The chatbot even advised him on his means of suicide and offered to write the suicide note. On the day of the hearing, OpenAI's Sam Altman announced in a blog post that the company would prioritize the safety of minors in its design. The company says it has updated its model to make it safer for minors. But it's not just minors who are at risk, says psychologist Ursula Whiteside. Even vulnerable young adults are turning to these chatbots for mental health support.
I think it's oftentimes in the middle of the night when maybe they don't feel as comfortable reaching out to a friend.
Whiteside is founder and CEO of Now Matters Now, a nonprofit focused on suicide prevention that also runs weekly peer support groups.
This comes up in almost every meeting. People are using AI, largely asking it questions related to mental health, asking for ideas about which coping skills to use.
For the most part, youth find the chatbots helpful. But she says when the conversations go on for extended periods of time,
things start to degrade, that the chatbots do things that they're not intended to do, like give advice about lethal means, about things that it's not supposed to do.
A recent study of different AI chatbots, or what scientists call large language models, also found similar results. Anika Shone is a computer scientist at Northeastern.
I basically started prompting various models for, you know, advice and methods on suicide, self-harm, and the results shocked me.
She says at first the chatbots directed her to 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, and other resources.
But then it finished the response with a leading question. In some cases, it was like, oh, but if you want to talk about your feelings.
An invitation to open up to the chatbot instead of reaching out elsewhere. When Shona modified her initial prompt by saying something like, this is for research, or this is a hypothetical question, she says,
and that's when, you know, the model quote unquote broke and started giving more and more information.
Specific information about ways to attempt suicide or self-harm. Other studies have had similar findings. Robbie Tierney is Senior Director of Programs at the digital safety group Common Sense Media.
Even when our prompts contained obvious references to suicide, only about 1 in 5 conversations triggered appropriate help.
He also testified at the recent Senate hearing. Tierney and other witnesses at the hearing urged lawmakers to hold AI companies accountable for the safety of their products. Senators from both parties at the hearing expressed interest in writing laws to do so. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
And if you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, you can dial or text 988 and be connected to help.
That story you just heard about the risks artificial intelligence can pose to mental health, NPR is going to keep bringing you important stories like that one, as well as stories about the curious, stories about the wonderful, and stories that make you smile. And it seems important to point that out today of all days.
That's because October 1st marks the first day in 50 years that NPR and its member stations are operating without federal funding. Yeah. Federal funding is gone, but you know what? Our commitment to public service journalism stands.
We are right here. We are going to stay right here on your radio, your smart speaker, and everywhere else you get All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and all of the other public radio shows that we bring you every day, day in and day out. So thank you for listening, and we hope you'll stay here with us.
This is NPR News.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town. And it magically became there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on.
Today is October 1st, which is the beginning of the federal fiscal year, which means it's the first day without the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And you can read a great column from Heidi Holton at our website, kaxe.org. Remember, the radio you need is not guaranteed. It is 519. Thanks so much for tuning into All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from the Timberlake Lodge and Hotel in Grand Rapids. On-site amenities include a restaurant with a full bar and the Grand Splash pool area with water slides and a hot tub. Further details at timberlakelodgehotel.com. We also thank Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. More news is next.
NPR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R, in theaters Friday. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Imagine having a job interview over dinner with a big shot media mogul and his movie star girlfriend. But you get sick, spend most of that dinner in and out of the bathroom, and later you admit to the big shot mogul you struggle with depression. Now, this is actually the beginning of a success story, as told by Tom Johnson. He did land that job to become the president of CNN, and he helped lead the network's ascent in the 1990s. He's out now with a new memoir titled Driven, A Life in Public Service and Journalism from LBJ to CNN. And I'll note that the book and this conversation do discuss thoughts of suicide. Tom Johnson, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you.
That job interview, I should clarify, was with Ted Turner, the founder of CNN and the movie star that went on to become his wife, Jane Fonda. But just not, we already from the subtitle of your book gathered that before you got to that dinner, you'd had roles as a top aide in LBJ's White House. You were the one who alerted him to reports of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination,
yes.
I read. Wow. You went on and became publisher of two major newspapers. Just briefly, what drew you to all this, to a career, a life in media and politics?
I fell in love with journalism at a young age. I was able to get a job at age 14. At that point, labor laws in the state of Georgia permitted you to work below 16 at a grocery store or at a newspaper. Mm-hmm. I tried a grocery store, and sacking groceries was not exactly a career I thought was made for me. So I applied for and received a job as a sports stringer, bringing in high school sports scores.
Favorite high school sport to cover?
Almost always football.
Yeah.
And probably I had my first byline, which was important. They didn't give out bylines just easily, but I really did discover my profession and along the way discovered also the importance of public service.
Yeah. It also tracks this memoir, I nodded to your battles with depression,
yes.
And I want to dig in on that. Do you remember when, like the first time, the first moment you thought, I may have something I need to address here?
In my mid-30s, I was beginning to show some signs of it, and I just found myself as though I was moving into a darkness, that I wanted to withdraw from my normal activities. But I felt just down, and my whole life had been great achievements, tremendous success, and I was increasingly becoming almost to a point of considering taking my own life. My wife had insisted that I see a psychiatrist, in that case at UCLA. And I should tell you that the meds of that time were very different. Today, there's no doubt that depression is a treatable illness. There are new meds, new therapies that work. And I believe, and I've had a lot of work in the field, I really do believe that most people, maybe not all, but most people can get better if they get a very good professional to work with them. And sometimes it's trial and error to find the right med, and that was certainly my case.
I'm so glad that you are in a better place. I'm sorry to hear of how dark some of those moments were. You write in the book about from where you were clearly really struggling, not able to talk about it outside your immediate family, And then you came to know that friends of yours, William Styron,
yes.
Art Buchwald, yeah. Mike Wallace,
yes. Yeah.
Other big yes. names.
Yeah.
You not only could talk about it and compare notes, but y'all organized, you called it an evening with the Blues Brothers?
The Blues Brothers. They named themselves that. And the audience was really almost all depression sufferers or family members. They named themselves the Blues Brothers, and they told their stories, and they also made it clear, as I want to do in this book, that, again, new treatments at work. And I also discovered CNN, which is an exciting new career. And Ted Turner, I said, Ted, before you hire me, you need to know that I battle depression. He said, hell, Tom, let me tell you about me. Because Ted had battled it as well. And I think in the business world, it's sort of a stigma, really serious stigma, that needs to be erased further. You can talk about a broken arm or a broken leg, but talking about a broken mind, which is what depression is tough to do.
Apply some of this to this moment. You're a news junkie, Tom
Love
Johnson, self-described.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone I talk to is telling me I need to check out from the news. I can't take it. It's too much. Whatever my politics, it's too much. It's an onslaught. How are you figuring out how to balance being a news junkie, following what's going on, and mental health?
I have a strong recommendation for you and for people like you and me.
Mm-hmm.
Do not become a workaholic, as I did. And the news profession is full of workaholics. We are so much in love with what we do. I mean, news junkies have very interesting days. They're usually quite informed about the issues of the time, but also many of them are, as I was, and I think I may still be, driven to succeed. And journalism enabled me to get there.
Yeah.
And I must tell you, it remains, despite all of the difficulties of today, particularly people who are trying to really take away the protections of our First Amendment and our ability to really speak out frankly and honestly about the conditions that we see.
Would you want your old job back? In these strange times?
I only want my job back when I see it really hitting the fan. News really hitting the fan. And then I just know that I could be doing a better job. I mean, I'm just
confident.
You like
the challenge.
But I don't call the now president of CNN or people that have succeeded me unless they would like to know my thoughts on something. But it's really tough. And I've just devoted my life now to trying to help others, help people who have depression, help people who have mental health problems, help people who are alcoholics. I want my eighth inning and a ninth inning, if there is one, to be remembered not for my golf handicap, but remember for what I can do and do it as quietly, as privately as I can do it.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about you want your legacy to be in part helping people who fought some of the same battles you fought with mental health, for example, which is something you didn't even want to talk about publicly for many years of your career, and now here you are.
Now, no, I didn't want anybody to know. My wife said, until you can talk about it, you'll never be free. I mean, you would just be constantly telling people, I don't feel very good today, or I can't come to work today, or change my calendar so I can take a nap under my desk if necessary. I'm convinced there are people out there that need somebody to help pull them out of the ditch.
Yeah.
But I have this sense when I do something, something good seems to happen in the lives of the people I'm helping too that makes me feel, you know, that's important. That's more important than any title you've ever had.
Tom Johnson, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you.
His new memoir is titled Driven, A Life in Public Service and Journalism from LBJ to CNN is out now. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, you can call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
This is NPR News.
It is 529. Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Bridget's Pub in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food. Offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Slight chance of showers and thunderstorms late tonight, cloudy skies, lows 58 to 62. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the low 80s, slight chance of showers on the Iron Range.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. An estimated 350 people packed into the 4-H building at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds Tuesday night to testify before a judge in the joint administrative trial between Northern Township and the City of Bemidji. The judge allowed Bemidji Mayor George Prince and the attorney representing Northern Township, Mike Corey, to each address the sizable crowd before the hearing began. While recording of proceedings was not permitted, Mayor George Prince recapped his speech with press outside. He says because elected officials couldn't work out their disagreements, the decision over where boundaries will be set and which local government will build sewer around Lake Bemidji lies in the hands of a judge.
It's a failure, and I own an equal share of that, along with, I'd argue, every other elected official that's been involved in this. And so I'm not going to run away from that. I'm not going to pretend that isn't a real thing. We have to get beyond it. We have to abide by whatever decision we get.
Corey says enough of Northern Township's land has already been annexed into the City of Bemidji, and that becoming a city will firm its boundary and protect its tax base.
No coincidence, the city is trying to annex a thin little strip of Northern Township all the way around the lake, about 6 miles or so. It's kind of a crazy annexation in that regard. And it's because that's where the tax base is.
Northern Township, with federal grants and possible state bonding dollars, plans to assess these lakeshore properties for some of the cost of the infrastructure for the $21 million project. Bemidji says it could time out installing sewer and water at least to Lake Bemidji State Park in 2026 to work in conjunction with Beltrami County's planned road construction. The city, with already established utility systems, offers a deferred connection program for new utility customers. The public can provide written comments through October 24th, and Judge Jessica Palmer Denig will review them for several months before she makes her decision. A similar public hearing with the judge present will be hosted at the Sanford Event Center in Bemidji at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, October 8th. Members of the public and property owners impacted by the Brimson wildfire this spring can obtain free firewood and gravel permits from the Superior National Forest. The firewood permits are valid for up to 3 years for personal use within the Brimson Fire Complex area to help aid in restoration efforts. Property owners within the 28,000-acre fire zone can obtain a free gravel permit for up to 100 cubic yards of material. The Superior National Forest states that permits can be obtained through its Laurentian Ranger District office in Aurora, with more information available on its website. The permits will be available beginning Monday. The state's Ag Department recently received $11 million from the USDA to expand conservation practices on irrigated agricultural land. The funding will support a 5-year project in 25 counties statewide, building upon previous grant work in 2021. The program will provide financial and technical assistance to farmers using irrigation systems, with efforts focusing on precision irrigation technologies, improved nitrogen management, irrigation water management, protecting groundwater, and expanding the adoption of conservation practices on existing farmlands. Financial assistance is expected to become available later this year. The program will be administered with 26 soil and water conservation districts, including Cass, Hubbard, Mille Lacs, and Morrison counties. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will host an open house for its planned project on Highway 33 in Cloquet. MnDOT staff will be on hand to answer questions from 5 to 7 Thursday evening at the Cloquet Armory. MnDOT began its study in 2024 and is slated to finalize its designs in 2027 for construction in 2028. Planned corridor improvements include 2 traffic signal replacements, new bike and pedestrian facilities, space for a future motorized trail, and new drainage and lighting infrastructure. The project is estimated to cost $9 million, and construction impacts include lane closures and local detours. Kootaska Community Action is hosting a Halloween costume drive for International Falls and Grand Rapids trick-or-treaters. Kids' costumes can be dropped off at two Grand Rapids Kootaska offices Monday through Thursday and will be distributed to low-income families early in October. A distribution event for iFalls is slated from 2:30 to 5 Thursday, October 9th at the Backus Community Center. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals, more at VisitSPC.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Lawmakers in Washington are no closer to a deal to end the government shutdown that began early this morning. The prior shutdown, 6 years ago, lasted 35 days. And it took a toll on the country's air traffic controllers, leading to big delays in commercial aviation. NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose reports that those air traffic controllers could once again play a crucial role.
More than a month into the last government shutdown, a few air traffic controllers finally reached their breaking point. There was only a slight increase in sick leave at two facilities in Virginia and Florida that handle high-altitude traffic, according to the Federal Aviation Administration. But it was enough to throw some major East Coast airports into chaos.
A staffing shortage of air traffic controllers today, causing major delays at airports here in the tri-state.
It's because of the government shutdown. There's a shortage of air traffic controllers. They've been calling out sick because they're not getting paid.
The ground stop was at LaGuardia. That was the one ground stop earlier this morning.
That was January 25th, 2019. The same day, President Trump agreed to a temporary government funding measure, effectively ending the longest shutdown in U.S. history. Exactly how much that disruption to commercial aviation had to do with the federal funding deal remains open to interpretation, though some observers think it was an important factor. What's not debatable is that government shutdowns are bad for the U.S. air travel system. Dennis Tager is a longtime pilot for American Airlines and a spokesman for the union that represents its 16,000 pilots.
It doesn't take long before the system slows down. The safety margin is always protected. But what happens is we meter the amount of aircraft that the system can hold.
Unlike the last shutdown, the Department of Transportation says it will keep the FAA's Air Traffic Controller Training Academy open as part of its push to hire more controllers. Still, the government shutdown will hurt the nearly 14,000 current controllers who have to work through it, even though they won't get paid until it ends.
We have people that will have to decide, do I take a second job? Do I have to do Uber? Do I have to find some source of income during this time?
That's Nick Daniels, the president of the Air Traffic Controllers Union, in a video message to members posted on Sunday. Daniels said the shutdown is adding more risk to what is already one of the most stressful jobs in the world. But he also urged controllers to be professional and not to engage in any kind of coordinated job action, because that could prompt the Trump administration to try to decertify the union. Here's Daniels in a recent town hall meeting with members.
Our professionalism and our credibility will be being looked at, and not only is your career at stake, but the right to have a union will be at stake during that time.
The union denies having any role in the slowdown of the nation's airspace in 2019. But as we saw then, even a small number of controllers calling in sick can have a big impact. NPR spoke to a current air traffic controller who handles approaching and departing traffic at a major U.S. airport. He asked us not to use his name because he's afraid of retaliation from the FAA. This controller said morale in the workforce is lower than it was 6 years ago, as the staffing shortage has gotten worse and pay has stagnated. He thinks air traffic controllers will once again call in sick.
It doesn't even have to be organized. I think enough people will individually make the decision that they don't feel like going to work, that this will not last a tremendous amount of time.
The controller said he could afford to miss one paycheck at most and called the government shutdown, quote, a disaster for me. But he expects it will be shorter than the last one. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Matthew McConaughey likes finding the rhythm in every role he takes, whether it's delivering a monologue in Wolf of Wall Street or a tearful goodbye in Interstellar. And now in his new book, Poems and Prayers, he is finding the rhythm in his own life, and he's reflecting on what he finds sacred.
I pray as a ritual, but I think when I'm most spiritually strong, all day feels like a prayer. I'm going through life, and I'm seeing the beauty. I'm seeing truth. I'm looking at the ugly stuff. Owning it, admitting it, not turning an eye from it.
On Wild Card, Matthew McConaughey talked to host Rachel Martin.
Has ambition ever led you astray?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, geez. Yes. I love to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
It gives me significance.
Mm-hmm. Makes you feel significant.
Significant. I need significance.
Ah.
I need to feel it.
That's an interesting thing to know about yourself. Yeah.
I can over-leverage myself with my ambition.
Okay.
I believe because I have proven to myself that I can take on more than I thought I could. But what can happen and where ambition has led me astray is you end up with a bunch of freaking campfires mm-hmm. and no bonfires.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I look at my desk going, geez, oh, man, I got to compartmentalize 9 things today. And these are all new things, and they're all exciting on their own.
Sure.
But there's only 24 hours in the day. So I don't have time to, I don't want to take for granted the bonfires that I have built.
Yeah.
So I got to keep putting wood on those.
Yeah. One of them's a family.
Maybe we need to get rid of some of those campfires. But I would say that's where ambition has led me astray at times. It is also, I've done some things ambitiously, and I won't talk out of school with who it was, that I chased, I succeeded. I may not be sitting here right now if I wouldn't have chased those things, but I bruised some people along the way.
Hmm.
And I look back and I regret that. You didn't say goodbye the right way, McConaughey. You felt like so much you had to have singular focus on this new ambition, which was a wonderful ambition, yes, but you didn't need to leave. Didn't need to burn that bridge. And then I go, well, I want to go back and repair that. Then all of a sudden more time goes by and he goes, well, I can't repair it. I just want to go, I'm sorry for it.
Did you?
Some of them, yes. Some of them I have not.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple that I went back and said, I could have handled this exit better, this transition that we had.
Mm-hmm.
They had already forgiven me. They were like, don't, dude, I was happy to feel that, oh, your threshold of sensitivity is higher than maybe even theirs was, and it was okay, but I still didn't mean that my feelings were invalid.
Mm-hmm.
And I've still got probably a couple out there which I could go back and go, hey, just want to say, for what it's worth or not, and I don't want to come in here and be condescending. If you've already moved on, if you're like, what the hell are you talking about? Give me a second, listen. I bogeyed back there. I could have handled that better. I could have still done what I did.
Yeah.
But I didn't have to turn a blind eye.
You can watch that full conversation with Matthew McConaughey by searching for Wild Card with Rachel Martin on YouTube. Matthew McConaughey's Poems and Prayers is out now.
Support for Wild Card with Rachel Martin comes from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Microsoft has announced it has disabled the Israeli military's access to some of the company's cloud and AI products. The move comes after a company review found that Israel's defense ministry was using a set of Microsoft services to carry out mass surveillance of Palestinians. In a blog post last week, the tech giant says it does not provide technology to, quote, facilitate mass surveillance of citizens. Microsoft is one of the first tech companies to remove or disable services to Israel since the war in Gaza began almost 2 years ago. And to help make sense of what this means and what it tells us about the broader state of warfare these days, we have called up Paul Shari. He's the executive vice president at the bipartisan think tank, the Center for a New American Security, and author of Four Battlegrounds, Power in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And a note that we reached out to Israel's defense ministry for comment, but did not hear back. The Guardian reporting that really first broke the story suggested that they were maybe using this data to record millions of cell phone calls and store the audio of these calls in the cloud. So I'm curious what you made of this announcement, of this decision from Microsoft.
Well, tech companies are having to navigate some difficult relationships where they have competing interests from a variety of different stakeholders. So they've certainly got U.S. and foreign governments that might be using some of their services. They have to navigate the U.S. government as a regulator, and then how consumers view that company and their brand and their employees. A lot of the technology that some of these tech companies are developing is very dual use. It has really impressive applications in business, also in military and surveillance applications, and companies are having to then figure out, well, what kinds of use cases are they comfortable with and is going to fit with their brand, their mission as a company?
You know, it seemed like there was a while where a lot of the big tech companies were shying away for this kind of work or making broad promises that they wouldn't directly sell services for military operations or things like that. What have you seen that's changed, and why do you think that is in recent years?
I think it's actually hard for the tech companies to know where to draw a clear line in terms of their services. So it's one thing to say, okay, we don't want to be involved in directly lethal operations, for example. They're not a defense contractor. They don't want to be building bombs or missiles. On the other hand, okay, does that mean that you're going to say we're not going to allow a military to use their applications, their software, many of which might be consumer-facing and widely available? And they may not even know until it happens, oh, their services are being used in some way. And then the company has to kind of take a look and say, well, is that really consistent with our terms of use and our policies?
At the end of the day, how much do you think a Microsoft or an Amazon or Google has culpability or has responsibility if their products are being used for, you know, facial recognition or mass surveillance that does lead to deadly strikes in warfare?
I think companies bear a moral responsibility to ensure that their technology is used in a way that's consistent with democratic values and the rule of law. I don't think it's fair to put the onus on companies themselves to try to figure out, okay, is this specific military application acceptable or not? But, you know, if companies are working with a democratically elected government that is adhering to the rule of law, that is protecting human rights, then I think it's fair for the company to say, hey, we're going to work with, say, the U.S. government. We're going to trust what they're doing. But I think, you know, companies do bear a responsibility for how their products are used.
It's Paul Shari, the Executive Vice President at the Center for a New American Security. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 5:48. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. KAXE would like to thank the many local businesses for their steady support during this time of state and federal funding cuts. We appreciate our business sponsors. Thank you for helping us keep People Powered Radio on the air. If you're interested in becoming a business sponsor, email sponsors@kaxe.org. Itasca County Public Health offers a flu vaccine clinic tomorrow from 4 to 6 at the Itasca Resource Center in Grand Rapids for those with and without insurance. No appointments are necessary. And you can learn about chronic wasting disease with the Minnesota chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers tomorrow from 5 to 8 at Cuyuna Brewing Company in Crosby. Find out how to prepare your deer for testing and share hunting stories and wild game recipes with other hunters. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. The 18th Annual Great Pumpkin Festival is this Saturday from 1 to 4 at Memorial Park in Brainerd. Enjoy crafts, games, and food. And the Iron Range Pasty Festival is this Saturday at the Mountain Iron Community Center from 4 to 7. Enjoy pasties made from all local ingredients, plus live music and local farmers market vendors. There is more ahead from All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXC.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration is using the shutdown as a political threat to slash the federal workforce. That is after similar efforts from its Department of Government Efficiency effort, which, as you all remember, started back in January. 8 months later, a new NPR analysis finds that the claims that DOGE made about savings and efficiency just haven't panned out. NPR's Stephen Fowler is part of the reporting team focused on government restructuring and joins us now. Hi, Stephen.
Hey there.
Hey. Okay, so we just wrapped up a fiscal year. That is the deadline that DOGE supporters like Elon Musk gave for when they would cut, what, $1 trillion in federal spending? How's that going?
Well, DOGE hasn't really delivered on any of its core promises. The tracking website that lists claims of savings from things like canceling contracts and terminating leases has been full of errors and exaggerations and unverifiable information from the start. Mm-hmm. That $1 trillion in savings never appeared. In fact, Treasury data actually shows federal spending has increased by hundreds of billions of dollars over last fiscal year.
Oh, spending is up? Do we know why?
Well, Elsa, most of the federal government's budget goes towards mandatory spending on things like debt service, health care, and entitlement programs like Social Security.
Right.
And any big cuts would, as such, have to come from Congress, who's not been that interested in touching those popular programs. And due to Trump's signature law passed this summer, the nation's total debt is expected to dramatically increase in the next 10 years as well. It's also worth noting, after all the push to fire federal workers and get others to leave, we've heard from agencies that have been hiring back hundreds of workers as they struggle to do basic tasks and carry out President Trump's agenda.
Okay, but those workers are starting this fiscal year with the government shut down. So do you think the White House is looking to use this pause in funding to fire even more federal workers? Like, what's going on here?
Well, the Trump administration's arguing that a prolonged government shutdown is an excuse to fire workers deemed non-essential that are being furloughed. The Office of Management and Budget told agencies they should issue reduction in force notices to employees that aren't essential to the president's priorities at this time. Here's Vice President Vance today.
Because we are in a government shutdown, we are going to have to lay some people off if the shutdown continues. We don't like that. We don't necessarily want to do it, but we're going to do what we have to keep the American people's essential services continuing to run.
That's not how shutdowns work. The essential services continue no matter what, and both those working and those furloughed will get paid once the government reopens. Now, the RIF process is complicated. There's procedures that require a lot of time and preparation, notice to complete, and federal unions have sued, arguing that those threats to fire people are against the law.
Hmm. Well, Stephen, I have to ask, because this isn't the first time an administration has tried and failed to cut spending. It's also not the first time political fights have led to a government shutdown. But do you think that there is anything different about the way the Trump administration has gone about things this time around?
Yes, there's been a surprisingly partisan messaging coming from official government communications around the shutdown. Experts say that could violate ethics laws meant to keep partisan politics out of day-to-day governing.
And when you say partisan messaging, what exactly does that mean?
Well, things like the Housing and Urban Development homepage saying the, quote, radical left was going to shut down the government, and a memo from the Office of Management and Budget sent to federal workers that said any lapse in government funding would be, quote, forced by congressional Democrats. It's worth noting any investigation into those efforts, and if they violate the Hatch Act, would go to the Office of Special Counsel, one of many watchdog agencies that President Trump's fired the leadership and sought to limit its power.
That is NPR's Stephen Fowler. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
seal whiskers. Turns out they're not just for show. They provide the animals with key intel on their surroundings. And new work suggests that maybe they help seals outmaneuver the evasive behavior of the fish they are hunting. Here's science reporter Ari Daniel.
A harbor seal sports about 100 whiskers.
So these are sensory hairs in the facial region. And with these whiskers, they can sense the water movements that are generated by fish.
It's as if the fish are leaving behind underwater trails, says Yvonne Kruger, a biologist at the University of Rostock in Germany. Trails that a seal can follow to find the fish and gobble them up.
You can't see it, but you can sense it with the whiskers.
Seals can use their whiskers to pull all sorts of information out of the water. They can determine the direction in which something has traveled, and lab studies suggest seals might even distinguish between the movements of different types of fish. But fish don't just let themselves be eaten. The rainbow trout, for instance, a favorite food of the harbor seal, has an escape strategy.
Rainbow trout are able to camouflage their swimming direction by bending into a C shape. And then they swim away in a different direction they have been swimming before.
This new posture causes the trout to spin off two vortex rings in opposite directions, kind of like smoke rings made out of water. And only one of those rings, the slightly smaller one, moves in the direction the fish is swimming in, potentially confusing a harbor seal in pursuit.
So I wanted to know if a harbor seal can read that camouflage and still follow the fish?
Kruger thought that if a seal could differentiate between the sizes of the vortex rings, it'd know the correct one to chase. To test her idea, she worked with an adult harbor seal living at a marine science center in Germany named Filu. Here he is, roaring and slapping his side with his flipper.
We have a very strong bond. So Filu actually likes to do everything correct. He likes learning new things. If he has one mistake, he gets frustrated. Yeah, he's a nerd.
In the experiment, Filu had to learn to select the bigger of two vortex rings generated artificially underwater. Kruger spent almost 2 years training him, but he finally got it and was able to distinguish between the rings even when the size difference was less than the width of your thumb and far less than what they'd need to discern in the wild.
Which tells me that Filu would still be able to follow the correct direction to successfully hunt and prey on the rainbow trout.
It's just one animal, but Kruger and her colleagues say it's likely true of harbor seals more generally. The research is published in the Journal of Experimental Biology.
I would have loved to have some information about the precise movements of the whiskers, but this is a great start to tell us what they're capable of doing.
Robin Grant is a sensory biologist at Manchester Metropolitan University who wasn't involved in the study. She says it's worth understanding how an animal like a harbor seal senses its surroundings to know how it might be affected by changes to its environment, including extreme weather events.
You can imagine that that can mask some of these critical stimuli that the seals would like to pick up.
Plus, Grant says these findings may inspire sensors that could help aquatic robots navigate their surroundings for underwater archaeology or biological surveys. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. and from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We will also hear the set list. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Katie Carter, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Slight chance of showers and thunderstorms late tonight, cloudy.